Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and Will Campion and I have created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. We hope through direct and insightful interviews with masters of the real-life money maze, we're going to learn about different approaches to allocating capital, making investment and business decisions, and navigating the pitfalls that line the paths to prosperity. Whether you're a current or aspiring investor, entrepreneur, professional, or a student exploring career options, we hope you gain some helpful insights and enjoy the shows. You can keep up to date by visiting moneymazepodcast.com, and please sign up to our newsletter to ensure you won't miss a release. If you enjoy the show, please subscribe, and we'd love you to tell a friend or colleague about it. Thank you for listening. We're delighted to have Schroders as a sponsor and corporate partner. Schroders is a global investment manager whose purpose is to provide excellent investment performance through active decision-making. For more than two centuries, Schroders has evolved their understanding of markets, offering investment solutions across fixed income, equities, multi-asset, as well as private markets through Schroders Capital. Schroders actively invests in companies with responsible and durable business models. They're also a leading specialist in impact investing for clients who want to maximize positive change. Capital is at risk with investing. Bremont is also a sponsor of the Money Maze podcast. Bremont is a British company based in Henley that was established 20 years ago by two young brothers whose dream was to design and engineer beautiful chronometers. When Giles English, one of those brothers, appeared as a guest on the Money Maze podcast last year, he brought to life the wonderful history of British watchmaking, helping to explain why the world sets its time by Greenwich Mean Time, and he captured the incredible challenge of mastering the complexities involved in making exquisitely engineered timepieces. He has said, "Never judge one of our watches until you've held it in your hand and felt the quality." And both Will Campion and I have bought a watch, and we love them. Great innovation, a tangible love for their mission, resulting in beautiful, world-class luxury wristwatches. As we've been conducting this mini-series on private equity, I've been struck by a few things. I've only been a bystander as the world of PE has mushroomed, and in all honesty, probably had some reservations as someone brought up in the world of public liquid markets. And it came home to me as I read the 40-year history of the firm we're meeting today. That is that by most non-tech standards, this is a very youthful business. It's also one that has attracted talent, a lot of owners' capital at work in their funds, and no shortage of opportunity. And as we head into a more difficult investing era that at least I suspect could last for quite a while, dislocations and downturns set up opportunities. They cleanse, they allow for models to change, for firms to be re-engineered, refinanced, ownership to shift. And the winning PE firms will, I suspect, grow into more mainstream firms. So I think private equity will become more and more accepted and maybe assisted by the demise of the public markets, which we're going to talk about in this conversation. So today I'm in the London offices of Clayton, Dubilier & Rice, CDR. And I'm with Dave Novak, a 25-year veteran of the firm, but younger than me. Dave, welcome to the Money Maze podcast.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
A lot to talk about today, and I hope that we can talk a little bit about the evolution of PE models, the question about the abundance of capital, some of the emerging strains that we're seeing, maybe in the decline of IPOs, how PE models have evolved, and a little bit about the future and this whole public to private question. But I'd just like to jump briefly into you. I think you have a MBA from Harvard Business School and you have a BA from Amherst. And I just wondered what you think now looking back, each of those gave you.
I think in many ways, I was not one of those who had that grand plan of liberal arts college and then MBA. I went to a large state school in the middle of New Jersey, 750 kids in my class. So I always had a context of a big school. For those who don't know Amherst, Amherst is a small liberal arts college in America in which I had 400 people in my class. I went there initially to do sport. I enjoyed that. But when I got there, I realized how important to me being in a small school to really excite me and get me engaged in my academics, because there was no place to hide, first of all. And then second, you push against an open door with professors, because professors who teach at a place like Amherst are there because they like engaging with students. And I found it was very different than the large high school that I went to growing up. So that really fed the animal for me. I had an interest in economics, went on to be an investment banker at our respective alma mater at Morgan Stanley. I couldn't spell investment banking when I turned up at Amherst, and it was something that I realized that some older kids did as they left Amherst. I followed along dutifully, and it was a good fit for me in many ways in terms of the financial analytics, the financing characteristics, the deal doing. I happened to work in media at the time, and back then there were a bunch of private equity firms who had invested in cable companies. And that was my first exposure to private equity. And, you know, if I couldn't spell investment banking, I certainly couldn't spell private equity. But one of the things that I realized was there were a couple key attributes of private equity that were a better fit for me in terms of really trying to understand the businesses, how they make money, how they can compete, how they can create value. And I was able to then do my third year in 1993 in the private equity business of Morgan Stanley, which you'll remember back then, Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs had two of the larger private equity businesses.
Did you go to HBS before you made the switch?
No, I went to HBS after I made the switch. Went back after HBS for 8 months and then went to CD&R in 1997.
So let's start to talk about CD&R. You sent me the 40-year history of the firm. I have to say, somewhat reluctantly, I opened it the other night. And as I read it, it reminded me a little bit of the listening and hearing about the earlier days of Morgan Stanley after his genesis post JP Morgan. And that was what came back to me reflecting on the youthfulness of the business. But as I understand it, at that period, late 70s, there were three firms, you, Forstmann Little, and KKR. Just talk a little bit about how that business came about.
Well, it's an interesting story because Clayton and Dubilier were operators. They had founded a turnaround management firm. Basically, people call them business doctors. Other people call them turnaround artists or just folks who improve businesses. And they would get hired by owners of businesses to improve them. One of the things they figured out during that period of time was having an equity capability alongside that business building skill set would be a good way to approach some of these opportunities. Because what they found was oftentimes they'd go and fix a business and the owner of the business would make a lot of money as a result of their improvement. So that's when Joe Rice joined the firm. Joe Rice was a lawyer by training, but a deal person. In fact, he had a separate business prior to CD&R that invested in companies. And Joe also realized that just being a financial deal person on its own had its limitations. So they were both looking for each other. And then in 1978, Joe joined the firm. And that was the beginning of what I would call the private equity business that is CD&R today.
So you can reflect, having done this for 25 years, on how radically and rapidly it's changed. But for your firm, how has it changed most in the last period? And how is it changing?
In some ways, our business has changed a lot less than both of theirs. Because we were very similar in the 70s together. And of course, KKR today is a publicly listed global alternative asset manager. And of course, Forstmann Little hasn't survived the death of its founder, Teddy Forstmann. Whereas today, CD&R remains really a private equity firm that does its business through one fund and still has a significant amount of operating capability as part of the senior part of the members of our firm. So in some ways, we're true to the way we started. But of course, we've adapted to both the opportunity and the requirements as the industry has matured and grown. I'd say the biggest way, of course, is we manage a lot more funds. And today, we are very deep in industry sectors. So if you go back to 1978 and those early years, most of our operating executives were industrialists. Many of them ran diversified industrial businesses. And as a result, the firm looked at a variety of different industrial businesses where they can add value. Today, we're deep in five, soon to be six sectors: consumer retail, healthcare, services, industrial, technology, and soon to be financial services. And in each one of them now, we have operating executives aligned within those sectors who have deep expertise within those sectors. And in many cases, we have operating executives who have subsector expertise.
In one of your pieces, a line that got my attention was the comment that there are a number of structural advantages of PE for firms. Just tell me what they are.
I think there are a lot of them. And in truth, one can argue it's in some ways one of the best forms of capitalism. First of all, you have one entity that is the primary owner of the business. So it facilitates decision making. You can work very closely with the management team, agree strategy, agree tactics, and go forward together. Second, it allows the owner to be close to the business, because to facilitate that decision making, it really helps to have insight into what's going on in the business and in the market in which it's competing. Third, private equity is pretty facile at efficient capital structures. So getting the mix of debt and equity right to both facilitate growth, to facilitate equity returns, and also have a bit of a governing mechanism is important. So we're pretty good at that. And I think we're pretty good at attracting, retaining, and incentivizing management teams to create value.
And there was one line in this piece, which I thought was interesting, which is that what you bring is at times instilling a sense of urgency to the companies that you acquire. And just tell me, because that's a delicate path between excessive pressure and extraction of returns in your time horizon versus working with the folks running the company.
On the one hand, I would argue that private equity is longer-term capital than many people realize and or give it credit for. As a firm, our average hold period is over 5 years, and we've held businesses for more than 10 years, and some, of course, shorter than that. And at the same time, we realize ultimately to have a successful exit, you have to have a growth plan from years 5 to 10. You can't just be for the first 5 years. But this is important. This level of urgency is around defining the strategy, defining the initiatives that you want to go after to execute that strategy. What are the capital needs, the talent needs, sometimes the M&A needs, and then getting on with it. Because, of course, we're measured by how much value we create and how quickly we do it. Of course, that's the IRR calculation. And at the same time, which I think is important, and this level of urgency is important, is if we don't do it, if that company doesn't do it, one of their competitors likely will. So there's a competitive intensity and a requirement that drives this sense of urgency.
Let's talk a little bit about how this value creation that you are in pursuit of comes through growth. I think there is a certain amount of the skeptical community that say, well, PE is about extracting costs. But it's very clear to me reading your documentation that it's all about driving growth, which makes sense. But what does that mean practically?
It's interesting because now, of course, our industry is of a certain scale, and we're of a certain scale. We're regulated by the SEC, and we actually have to track a bunch of things now. And one of the things that we've tracked is how we created value in the companies that we've invested in. To your point, we have found that the earnings growth in our businesses are almost 50-50 attributed to sales growth and to margin improvement. And to your point, I think if you look back in the early days of the industry, 70s, 80s, 90s, it might have been more margin improvement. And back in those days, lots of leverage. For us, 80% of our value creation has been from EBITDA growth. And again, half top line and half margin. And I think there's a couple reasons why we've gotten to that point. First of all, very practically, cost actions are relatively well understood. They've been doing it for a while, and it's hard to differentiate just on that. Second, business environments generally are more competitive, and if you're not growing, you're going backwards. And third, to get good exits, you need to be a growing business. And by the way, you need to attract and retain talent. So we have very practically, that's an area of focus for us. And I think others have realized that as well.
And some of these forces acting on companies, and I think in the data that you had either quoted or I referred to, was that the activist demands of public companies is up sixfold since 2011, fourfold increase in companies planning to divest, and behind that is a lot of the technology function and need. So explain to me what you see as the forces driving behavioral change.
The investment industry has grown a lot from the time you and I both started in it many years ago. And I think the scrutiny on company performance and investment performance has increased. So as a result of that, you have a lot of different players who are trying to find ways to identify value and drive value, one of which, of course, are activists. I think private equity plays a role in that as well. When you're a public company, they get caught a little bit in this gerbil wheel of putting out projections of sorts or guidance of sort. They need to hit that guidance. In fact, they need to do slightly better than that guidance. And if they do that, investors are happy and the stock will go up. And then they have to keep doing that. So their incentive, of course, they need to grow. They need to do slightly better than their peer group. But there's no incentive to go for the home run. Because if you do that and you miss, then you're one of those companies that's missed its guidance, missed its numbers, and the stock could really adjust downward. So it creates this incentive of low volatility. I would argue, to a certain extent, lower ambition, leaving aside some of these technology growth businesses for a second. Very conservative capital structures, because more debt creates more volatility. And then ultimately, we would probably argue longer term results that are lower than they might achieve in a different environment.
Let me laser in on the technology, by which I mean technology is changing everything that every corporation does, but it requires expertise, talent, money, know-how, willingness as well. So is it causing some owners of businesses to realize that they just might not be up to it?
The word that a lot of people use now is disruption. So technology is a disruptive force for many businesses and industries. Technology is an industry sector on its own, and it's also a tool for businesses. So we're talking more about how it's a tool for certain businesses now. And the disruptive role of technology is really important. And what we are finding is that some businesses are at the forefront of that in their industries. Some are fast followers, and some, of course, lag. And those companies that are certainly the laggards very quickly. And the fast followers, sometimes they genuinely follow fast, other times they don't. So we have found that it's important in our operating toolkit to make sure that we have the technology skills to help companies who are somewhere in bucket 2 and 3 for sure of fast follower and laggards to either keep up or move to the forefront.
Tell me why and maybe when families or companies that have been around for a long time choose to come to you and choose to sell.
I think there are a couple of reasons. So one obvious reason is a family-owned business that doesn't have a natural succession within the family, so they decide they want to sell the business. And that's one area. I think the other area where we have spent a lot of time has been partnering with families in the businesses that they own, and oftentimes in the businesses that some member of the family still runs. And those situations have been really interesting for us because we've identified two consistent features in those businesses. One is they either have an opportunity that they want help realizing, or alternatively, they have a problem that they need some help or would like some help solving. Sometimes it's a little bit of both, by the way, but if you put it in those two buckets, there have been a lot of those situations. And we have found that with our deep industry sector expertise, combined with our operating capability, we could be a good partner to a bunch of these families to help take the business to the next level. So a big part of the investments that we have made, which is different than what you'd think about for traditional large cap private equity, have been these partnerships with families in which we buy a stake. Sometimes it's a majority stake, sometimes it's a minority stake, and create value together.
So you and many others in this private equity space have become very large firms. There's a lot of capital. How do you think about the abundance of capital and the potential compression of returns?
As I said, I first got into private equity in 1993. There's never been a time in which anyone has said, boy, private equity feels really easy today. It's just never happened. No one ever said, boy, there's lots of deals. Owners of business don't care what you pay for them, and there's no competition. It's just never happened. So it's a competitive industry. It's one of the things I like about it. It's competitive. A lot of really smart, ambitious people who want to make good investments. A lot of bankers and lawyers and other intermediaries who want to try and get prices up, all that. So that absolutely exists. I think the important characteristics today that make me feel confident that the industry can continue to do well, and then certainly CD&R strategy continues to be viable and attractive within it, is that the supply of deals in which private capital is a good alternative continues to grow. And I think it's for a couple of reasons. One is private equity continues to get better known, better understood, more accepted by all sorts of owners of businesses and actors in the industry. When I first came to Europe 22 years ago, that was certainly not the case in many countries in Europe and even in the UK. And you had terms like locusts and all of that. That has changed a lot today. And the second thing is this migration from, and you alluded to this, from public capital to private capital. I took a quick look at the data, and if you go from 2000 to today, basically, the number of public companies in the US has gone down by about a half, in the UK down by a third. So I think there's a recognition that private capital really is not only a viable long-term owner of businesses, even if it's not CD&R for 20 years, and as I said earlier, maybe a better sense of form of capitalism for companies.
So you've already taken us into this public to private migration. You've already hinted at some of the reasons why being a public company has its stresses and vis-a-vis expectations and either meeting them or not. But this seems to be, and I'm now going to shine the spotlight on the UK where you've been active and where I guess one recognizes there's a lot of good value by historic measures for all sorts of reasons that we're aware of. And there's been pension fund disinvestment for as long as we remember, accelerated by Brexit, etc. But what are you seeing and where do you think this plays out?
I think globally, notwithstanding what we all learned in business school, public markets are not short-term efficient. They might not even be medium-term efficient. So that's one fundamental aspect I think provides opportunities. I think there are times in which, as we see often, that industries come in and out of favor, companies come in and out of favor, and it's possible that for periods of time, maybe sometimes extended, those can be overdone one way or the other. Similarly, they might be overvalued at times, they can be undervalued. So that's the first thing. And you talked in one of your prior podcasts with Michael Lewis, and there's a lot about behavioral economics and how that influences investment behavior, and I think that's part of it. The second thing is that the public shareholders have a different set of priorities, a different set of influences on them. And we see in the UK market, in addition to this consistency of performance, oftentimes it's dividends, it's low leverage. There's a lot of governance requirements. I've found that, and I've sat on UK public boards with some of our companies that go public, the amount of time that you have to spend on other things beyond just strategic and value creative initiatives at the company is different. And by the way, I put ESG firmly in the bucket of improving businesses and creating value. So that's not part of it, but there's just other things. We have found that the ability to attract, retain, and compensate talent is very different. So I think those are all the factors. And you said it. If you look at the UK market in particular, it trades overall at a discount to European markets. The European markets trade at a discount to US markets. So there's all these structural factors put pressure overall in the UK. And as you suggested, that was an investment theme for us. And we've done three public to privates. UK and Ireland in the last 2 years, we made a strategic investment in another UK public company, a pipe. So we continue to believe that'll be a big opportunity for us and for the industry. I thought one interesting example of how public markets think about value relative to private markets is a bunch of the publicly listed private equity firms. I mean, TPG, I guess, was the most recent one that went public. And you see that the public investors valued the fee income stream much more highly than the carried interest. It's consistent, it's reliable, it's predictable. Now, of course, it's an incentive for the publicly listed private equity firms to grow assets under management, raise new funds. But if you ask any private equity practitioner, what do they value more, the management fees or the carried interest? Everyone would say the carried interest. The carried interest is more volatile, it's longer term in nature. At any moment in time, it's harder to predict. But we clearly would value that higher, whereas the public markets value the consistency, the predictability of fee income.
Well, I'm persuaded this is secular, not cyclical. So that allows us to drill into a couple of examples. You have acquired Morrisons. Tell me a little bit about your thinking, the process, timelines, expectations.
There are aspects of the public nature of the Morrisons process we didn't love. Having been in the UK now for 22 years, I was not surprised because we know how important the consumer brands are in the UK, the history of Morrisons, which has a terrific legacy, some specific examples of public companies going private, going public again that haven't worked so well. So we're acutely aware of some of the drivers of that. We had taken a view here in Europe really 15 years ago that retail overall was misunderstood and out of favor, both in the public and the private markets. That was a view that we had. It was interesting because for many years, it was a very popular place for private equity investment in Europe and in the UK. And that had changed. Terry Lee joined us. Vindi Banga joined us. So we had a lot of retail and consumer experience in the firm. And we felt like there were real pockets of opportunity in the retail space that potentially others didn't see. We're very thematic in our approach. So when Terry first joined, we did a bunch of work developing some key themes, and we identified some key themes. They included discount, value-based, retail, convenience, to name two. And we went about trying to identify opportunities in that, originally initiated in an opportunity with B&M Retail. Again, that was a family partnership. MFG, which is the leading forecourt convenience operator. And then as it relates to Morrisons, there were a couple things around some more recent themes we were focused on. We felt that grocery retail remains almost an infrastructure-like player in the lives of consumers in the UK. And I think in some ways, COVID made that more obvious to us, the importance of food. Second, we also felt that being able to get consumers their food in an omni-channel way was important. So you needed to have big stores for those who wanted to go do their traditional weekly shop. You had others who wanted to do daily or a couple times a week through a convenience format, and others did not want to go to any store and wanted to do it online, and mixes of all the above. And we felt like Morrisons was well positioned to do that. The third thing that was really important was really being conscious of and cognizant of your consumer, your end customer, and what is the power of your offering relative to consumer needs. And we thought that David Potts and his team had done a really good job over the last couple of years figuring that out, what Morrisons meant to the consumer, and had a good game plan that we thought we can support them in to continue to improve the consumer offering that would improve loyalty, improve sales, et cetera. And then finally, what Morrisons had, which I think was not as apparent and not, in our view, valued as well, was a bunch of other assets around it that we thought had real value. One was their vertical integration. They own a bunch of food, farms, et cetera. So they're vertically integrated. Their supply chain was well connected, which we know even more so now is important. Second, they had petrol forecourts and convenience on those, which we have a lot of experience in through MFG. So we understood the value of that, particularly in the context of the broader Morrisons offering. And finally, a bunch of property. So the overall entity, the sum of all those parts, we thought was greater than where the market was valuing it.
That's a very interesting analysis. I like your description of groceries or food retailers having an infrastructure-like quality. Now, I was playing golf last week. I was sitting with the three guys that I've been with, and one says, gosh, fantastic value in the UK. Have you looked at the SIG group? And one of the other guys goes, well, yeah, I own it as well. And then I think, hang on a second, I'm sure that's owned in part by CD&R, which of course it is. Now, this is a public company in which you have, I think, a 29% stake or thereabouts. How did that come about?
Funny story about SIG. It was the first investment that I looked at in 1999 when I started commuting from the US to Europe before I moved over here. We were looking at a going private of SIG in 1999. So it's a business we knew really well. And as a firm, we have a lot of investments in B2B distribution and particular expertise in construction product-related distribution. So it's a business model that we knew really well. We've continued to follow the business for a while. And I think distribution businesses, on the one hand, they sound really easy. You buy products from manufacturers and you sell them to contractors, and that should be easy. But it's really about doing a lot of little things right, both at the local level and the central level. And you'd be surprised how many distribution businesses lose their way. And SIG was one of them. It was a business that for years has been the market leader in the UK in both the distribution of insulation type products as well as roofing products, but had lost its way. And as a result, a business that we think could have 5, 6, 7% margins was losing money. And the beginning of COVID, they were in a real jam and they were looking for someone to help both financially and then bring some experience to the board. And so we got that call, and it's unusual for us. We don't do a lot of these public pipes. And of course, as you know, hadn't been one done in the UK for over a decade before we had done SIG. But to be fair, I think the board and their advisors did a good job acknowledging the situation at hand and led us do enough work to get the conviction that we needed, that we think over time it could return to historical levels of profitability. It can return to historical levels of growth. And then in these distribution businesses, then lead again further M&A consolidation, because scale matters in these distribution businesses. So we made the investment. Two of my team are on the board, and that's the history of SIG. The other reason I'm glad you raised it is that's an example in which private equity was a real solution, supporting a UK former champion, by the way, who was in trouble, and we can bring capital and operating expertise, and by the way, a commitment to longer term ownership. We agreed to lockups to help support what required a real transformation of the business.
Well, I hope you're enjoying this episode so far. We've got lots more to come, but a quick word on our new sponsor. Last year, I interviewed Gary Boom, CEO of Bordeaux Index. Wine is a great love of mine, and as he explained, Bordeaux Index has become a major disruptor in the way that wine is bought and sold, and has sought to redefine the way a wine merchant works. I've been really impressed with their business, and have been buying wine from them since that interview. So we're delighted that the Money Maze podcast is now also sponsored by LiveTrade, their world-leading fine wine trading platform. LiveTrade has changed the way fine wine is bought and sold worldwide. You can instantly buy and sell or place bids and offers on key wines from Bordeaux, Champagne, Italy, and other world regions. Their two-way pricing offers guaranteed trading liquidity with no fees. So I recommend you have a look at their website, bordeauxindex.com/LiveTrade. The Money Maze podcast is also brought to you by our final sponsor, Mintus. The world of art investing has been typically out of reach for most investors, and yet returns have been very impressive. Mintus is a new concept in art investing, giving investors the chance to own the unownable through an FCA-authorized and regulated fractionalization platform, which offers access to iconic and rare paintings from contemporary art masters like Warhol, Kondo, Francis Bacon, and Basquiat. Actual paintings, not digital assets. For investors seeking to diversify their portfolios through an asset class historically uncorrelated with stock market investing and with strong returns, we've been impressed with Mintus and think it merits a closer look. So you run Europe, we're talking about the UK, but some of these factors are very apparent in continental Europe as well, and okay with their linguistics and legal and other challenges and cultural challenges. How difficult or similar is it when you are running your slide rule over European landscape?
One of the fun things about Europe, and one of the reasons why I'm still here 22 years later, is it is a complex market, and that each country is different. It's not only language, but it's local rules, it's local customs, it's business practices, etc. We enjoy, and I enjoy, that level of complexity. I guess what I would say is there's similarities and differences in each country. Public to privates or investments in public companies are not easy in any country. There's regulatory reasons. There's reasons in which boards and or public investors would rather not have a private capital investor come in. It's sort of interesting. Oftentimes, if there's a need, sometimes the public shareholders don't want to put more capital in, but then they get frustrated if someone else from the outside wants to put the capital in. But I think we have, for the reason I said earlier, because private equity is better understood, there are some case studies now of good actors that it's more common today, and I think will continue to be. We are having 2.5 real dialogues with public companies on the continent right now in which we might provide a meaningful capital infusion.
So lots of opportunity, lots of capital, reasons to be excited. Sometimes it doesn't work out as planned. We know that the investment business is not unique, but people love to talk about successes and are very reluctant to talk about things when they haven't happened. When and where has it gone wrong, and what have you learned?
Well, it sounds trite to say you really do learn the most from the things that don't go as expected. And we've had some of those. Fortunately, not a ton, but we have had some. I would put the investments that haven't worked, the reasons, in three big buckets. First is a bunch of exogenous, out of our control events that happen to significantly impact one of our businesses. The two examples that come to mind, one was a business that served the oil industry this was a while ago, and oil prices were high initially when we made the investment. They got a lot lower. Even though we modeled it, it got a lot worse than we expected, and we couldn't adjust quickly enough. The second one was more healthcare related, and sometimes there are regulatory changes and or issues that happen. We spend a lot of time talking about them. You try and make an assessment as to whether or not it'll happen, and if it does, the impact on the business. But there has been an occasion where that subsumed all the good things we were doing in the business. So that'd be one bucket. I think the second bucket, which is completely on us, is sometimes infrequently, but there have been a couple occasions where we have missed the base earnings of the business. There are some situations in which owners and or sellers of business go out of their way to flatter the earnings of the business. We spend a lot of time trying to figure out what we think they are, but there has been a couple occasions, and you put a bunch of debt on a business based upon a set of earnings that end up not being as high as you expect, and you start that way, it's hard to work yourself out of that. And the third thing goes back to what we talked about, is there are times in which there are disruptive factors in the industry, either industry-wide or by players, that you may miss that could put a lot of pressure on your investment. So the important learning from all of that, and I actually genuinely believe, by the way, that the investment business is an experience-based business. The longer you do it, the better you get at it. You see more things, you've experienced more things, you learn more that you can apply. Now, some people say, older people like you and me, Simon, are set to historical ways of looking at businesses. I don't know. I don't want to believe that. But I do think it's an experience-based business. So every time something doesn't go as expected, we apply that to our analytical framework for the next deal.
And how many people have dealt with inflation? How many people now actually didn't even live through the dot-com crisis, let alone any of the others that have punctuated the investment market?
So we've been spending a lot of time talking about that, because you're absolutely right. If you think about the age curve of the people in all our investment businesses, many have not ever experienced inflation. And the other interesting thing that we're talking about now is supply chain. So if you think about the last decade, maybe more, the focus on supply chain has all been about just in time, the most cost effective, often leads to single suppliers in lower cost countries, all which made a lot of sense until it didn't, which is where we are now. You add on top of that a little bit of nationalism. And if you think about the investments that may be required in local and or duplicative supply chains in our businesses, you can think of that almost now as risk management, a form of insurance to a certain extent. And that's a totally different perspective that we will have on our existing businesses and some of our investment theses going forward.
I've just written this down. Supply chain reviews is a type of risk management. It's absolutely right. So this deglobalization, I guess, is only just beginning, or is that just too simple?
My own view is it's too simple, but what I would say is that our view of globalization will be slightly different going forward than it is today. Because I don't think it means not having a supply chain that includes China. You would never have that rule going forward, but it certainly can mean having more suppliers, maybe more local, etc.
Great. I would like to ask you some general questions. You sit on the Cambridge University Endowment Investment Board, and we had Tilly Franklin, who is the CIO there, on a podcast last year, which was really interesting. But how did it come about that you find yourself on that board?
First of all, I think Tilly's great. She's really good at her job and a great person. So I'm delighted for her and delighted for Cambridge. I always had a lot of respect for her investment acumen and her personal characteristics, and I think it was relatively mutual, at least. So as she took on that role and was in the process of trying to constitute a new investment board, she asked me to join. Obviously, I can add some value around the private equity area.
I've sat on and still sit on some investment boards. They're good ones, they're bad ones. Reflecting on, yes, you have this private equity expertise, but more broadly, when you sit around and have your committee meetings, what is it that you hope you are able to do?
I have to tell you, I always wonder whether I'm adding any value to Tilly. That's the first thing. So I hope that along the way, she will think that spending those couple hours with me is marginally better than not. I don't know if that's the case, but I hope. I think what Tilly and the board is good at is trying to solicit viewpoints, questions, challenge. And by the way, that's another really important thing, I think, to have sustainable, strong investment performance, is finding a way, and it's really cultural, to solicit input. Importantly, input that may have a different point of view. It's something that we do at our firm all the time. In fact, we go at length, both have, as you know, a lot of operating executives who are constantly being solicited for their input. Terry Leahy's forgotten more about retail than we'll ever know. But I want Terry's point of view on an industrial transaction. And I want an industrial person's view on a retail transaction, because business people and or investors see lots of things. It goes back to this experience point. And you want to make sure at least it comes out. And Tilly's really good at that. And the investment board is doing that. So it facilitates a private equity guy asking a question about real assets and a fixed income person asking a question about public equity that I think ultimately gets to better decision making.
As you look around the world at so many corporations, is there one that stands out in terms of one that you particularly admire today around the world?
Would it be unfair to pick one of ours? Because there is one.
Yes, we'll allow you that. But you're going to have to give me another one as well.
I'll give you another one. A company I really admire is a company called Belron, which is the global leader in auto glass repair and replace. So in the UK, it's auto glass. In America, it's Safelite. And the reason I admire it is a couplefold. First of all, they're a leader in their space. But they have embraced, particularly over the last now almost 5 years we've been associated with them, they've embraced what it means to be a leader in its broadest sense. Best customer satisfaction, best service levels, best financial metrics, best talent capabilities, hiring, training, retaining, and also a focus on a social responsibility. So they're really good at all of those things. And its leader, its CEO, Gary Lubner, fully embraces this concept of getting input and focus on being a leader in everything that they do. It's very easy to say, I'm great at 85% of things. That's good. That's great. That's good enough. That's not how they're wired. I always think about it, particularly as it relates to our business, back to how I talked about, if you think about what is your outcome goal, what are you trying to achieve as a measurable result, whatever that is. Again, for us, it's investment performance. Then you can go backwards and think about what are the things that you need to do to get there. If you are ambitious in your goal setting and that's your true north, then you can be pretty unemotional about all the things you have to do. And if it means having five investment committees over three, or if it means for Belron saying how we think about return on capital, even though it's worked for us for 20 years, isn't the best way, or maybe the way we serve a customer is inefficient, even though we thought it was good. That's how you continuously improve. So they're really good at that.
And outside of your portfolio?
I'm going to be unoriginal and probably say Apple. And the look on your face says, yes, that's exceedingly unoriginal. And I admit that. Great innovation, great technology, customer-centric. But importantly, if you go back through the history, and this is what I really appreciate about Apple, they had their bump in the road too. A meaningful bump in the road. Wasn't clear they'd ever make it. And I am sure somewhere in all of that, and there's a lot written about Steve Jobs, but there was an outcome focus and a willingness to do the hard things to get there.
Two closing questions, Dave. Advice for young people, whether they're students or younger people in their careers, thinking about finance and thinking about private equity, what advice would you offer them?
Sir Ken Robinson always had an interesting thing, which he would talk about finding that marriage between what you're good at and what you like to do. And if you can find that, you'll be successful. So I get that finance and private equity has a broad appeal to some. I would tell everybody, make sure you understand what it is and what your day job would be. Always be honest with yourself. Is that what you like to do? And is that what you're good at? And if you think the answer to that is yes, particularly for young people, we've discussed just a little bit. Financial world, private equity, private capital is very big and very fragmented still. Part of the reason why I'm still very positive about our opportunity. So I'd say in the early days, try and get as many experiences as you can. Talk to as many people as you can to understand those differences and where you might have more of an interest, more of a capability, and more of an opportunity.
If you could tell us just one thing.
Easy is overrated. And it sounds like I'm pounding my chest. I'm not. And part of that relates to my own experience in building this business here. The quick history of 22 years ago when a bunch of other 30-something-year-olds came over to start this business. And I realized pretty quickly there was a whole bunch more I didn't know than what I did know, and all the mistakes that follow from that. Combined with, as you pointed out, plenty of competition, I think that in the long run makes you better. But you got to get through it, so don't shy away from that.
So I know I asked you to just tell us one thing, but I know from an earlier conversation there are a couple of other really interesting thoughts you had in terms of advice.
I would encourage people, which might sound a little bit surprising, to share your success gratuitously. with everybody around you. And own your failures, own your mistakes, solely yourself.
So I know you're also on two other boards, the board of Amherst College and ASL, the American School in London. I know quite a few of our listeners and friends have children there. Why have you given up time to commit to that?
Well, I care deeply about education. Educating our youth today is arguably one of the most important things for the future. And I believe a lot in mission-led education, in which ASL and Amherst College both follow. And it's interesting as education has changed, or a lot of schools have focused on who they educate, and it goes back to some of the time I spent with Tilly at Cambridge, the importance of endowment, the importance of the financial equation is increasingly important to support innovation, to support program, and to support financial aid. So to the extent I can be helpful in any of those ways, I'm very happy to do so.
Dave, that's been a really enjoyable, interesting, insightful conversation. Lots to take away for listeners, for myself. I'm going to just pick on two, probably because it's something I feel strongly about. The investment business, you said, is an experience-based business. And I would advise anybody to go look at the history books, because it might be super important for the next 5 or 10 years. And as far as PE is concerned, firms like yours see lots of runway for opportunity, notwithstanding cyclical downturns. I think the focus, the early point you made about you can offer businesses a more efficient capital structure is often overlooked. And as you invest in these businesses, yes, everybody focuses on the management fees, but the carried interest, which is valued very highly by the PE folks, just says how much opportunity, I guess, you see in these businesses and how exciting the outcomes can be. So with that, I thank you very much for agreeing to be on the Money Maze podcast today.
Thank you, Simon.
Thank you for listening to the Money Maze podcast. For more information or to subscribe, please visit themoneymazepodcast.com. Hope to see you next time. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only, and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.